Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. It is no secret that the backbone of the British Army is its non-commissioned officers. My guest for this edition of General Talk is Warrant Officer Class 1, Colin Kirkwood, Scots Guards, now Academy Sergeant Major, the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, a post traditionally known as the top dog. The epitome of the very highest standards, his predecessors are legendary men like Ray Huggins and J.C. Lord. But the majority of Academy Sergeant Major Kirkwood's military career has not been giving words of command on the drill square, but as an armoured infantryman amongst the oil, dust, dirt and grease of the Warrior AFE while on operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Had his mother not hung up the phone on him when he tried to leave basic training at the age of 16, there'd be no story to tell. To be at Sandhurst, he says, is a great honour. Go away to your regiments, he tells officer cadets, and think of the instructors and people you saw here as the example, so you can say to your young sergeants, this is what I want you to be. I hope you enjoy the programme.
You must be very proud to be here at Sandhurst. You finished being Sergeant Major of your battalion, now sitting in the chair where great Sergeant Majors, people like Ray Huggins, John Lord. How do you feel to be in that position?
I think it's probably the one job that, if you've been to Sandhurst as a call sign, it's probably the one job you think, I'd love to do that. Because you just look at that board every day of walking in and the names on it, I know you're in here. And essentially your role here is evolved over the years, but now I spend very little time in the office because there's no point. I am out, either talking to people, trying to inspire, coach, mentor, lead by example all the time, make sure the standards are upheld in the academy, because that's the basis of everything here. So there's little things of discipline, showing the officer cadets that this is the way to do things, this is what we expect, go away to your regiments and think of the instructors and people you saw here as the example, so you can say to your young sergeants what I want you to be. So yeah, it's a great honour for me, and then I was always focused on getting the troop of colour out of the way and getting here. That's great.
You hadn't done any ceremony or soldiering for about 19 years and things, right? Yeah. And then suddenly you find yourself on the prime focus last year as Sergeant Major on the troop of colour. How was that to be with all the focus on you and the ensign and that colour at Windsor?
When I knew I was going to do it, there was originally going to be, we're going to go to Iraq and I would potentially miss the troop in the colour, but I was so glad that COVID played a part. But when I got told, right, it's happening, and F Company last troop in the colour in 1997, that was the year before I joined the army, so all the old boys couldn't wait for it. The people in F Company, ex-F Company, all wanted this to happen, so it was a massive event for the 7 and ex-7 community, because they really wanted it to happen, and to happen in such a little private event, it seemed like, just for us and Her Majesty in Windsor, was amazing. We only stepped on Windsor once for a rehearsal, that's all we're allowed. It was COVID played havoc with some of the soldiers there, so that was dynamic. But I have to say, it wasn't for the Coldstream Guards, the Sergeant Major of the Coldstream Guards and the sort of the hierarchy there helping us out with the training, then it probably wouldn't have happened, but they were fantastic. So they sort of ran everything behind the scenes, and there was times where I could just act as a bod on parade and concentrate and occasionally pop out, but the coaching guards are very good, and without them, the parade probably wouldn't happen. But oh, that was another great honour to hand over the colour in front of Her Majesty, draw your sword, and I'm probably the only Sergeant Major that's actually marched off with his sword drawn, because usually put it away, but I was allowed to march off with it drawn all the way back, which is great, and now I get to draw my sword again on the Sovereign's Parade, which not many people, that was twice, so double honour. But the trip was great, it really was. It was all the effort, we got quarantined for 3 days to go in a reserve centre, just hoping nothing could go wrong. But even though there was probably 6 people on parade that had not done any rehearsals, it went off without a hitch, and that was probably one of my most proudest moments, because the last time I did the troop recall, 19 years previously, I was only a guardsman or lance corporal, so just a bullet, but actually been on it, centre of focus, attention was great, and the young officer did really well. I think he was really nervous, and we messed up every rehearsal, but got it right on the day.
You are now the top dog, the Academy Sergeant Major, and since 2015, the Army Sergeant Major and the whole Command Sergeant Major system has been introduced. How does the top dog, the Academy Sergeant Major, Senior Warrant Officer of the British Army, how does he fit into that now?
So I think traditionally, yeah, the Academy Sub-Major has always been one of the sort of senior mentors for the other warrant officers here, because you're obviously commissioned and I've got 15 warrant officers underneath you here. But I think the Command Sub-Majors, we all fall into a bracket underneath the Army Sub-Major. So the Army Sub-Major is the eyes and ears for the Army, for all, for everyone to ask advice to and stuff, because he's got obviously next to the CGS. But yeah, I think it's a good system, and we're in comms quite regularly, myself and the Army Sub-Major. But I think it's good for soldiers and officers to have someone outside of the normal chain of command. They can get stuff done, they can ask questions, they can find stuff out, because the people in the Brigade Sub-Major and the Command Sub-Major roles are next to people in positions of power where they can get answers and feed it down. And different people have varying degrees of success in the job, but I think personality is a big part of it, character. But definitely think it's worth it. I like the role of the Army Sub-Major. It's a good tool to have for us as a bit of top cover, and to ask advice, because they've generally been through all the steps, through all the different Sub-Majors and that. So it's good. But for here in Sandhurst, it's me essentially, and trying to keep Sandhurst running on the traditions and the standards of the past, but keep going forward and mentoring the young officer cadets and the staff to the way the Army wants to go in the future. So that's the way we're going. We're trying to keep that steady balance between this is the way it's done, always been done, but we actually have a nod to the future and get a light hand on the tiller, as they say, to go forward.
The foot guards and the House of Cavalry and the House of Division are much smaller now than they used to be. Do you think it will always be the case that the Carry Sergeant Major will be a guardsman or from the House of Division?
No, I don't. I think it's nice that the guards have got it, and I think it's probably always in reference to the Sovereign's Parade. Big massive, really complicated parade. A lot of staff and officer cadets on parade. But I think in the future, does it need to be? No. There's plenty of high quality warrant officers from throughout the Army that can do this job. I just think if they are going to change it in the future, it just needs to be bolted properly with the number of different candidates and various interviews and stuff like that. But once you're here, Sandhurst sort of takes over, and as long as you've been here before and you understand the place, I think it could change. You never know. It's nice that the girls have got it, but I think they'll open up everything to the Army in the future. It's only fair.
And of course, congratulations to you, because you know that you've got a commission. That's all great stuff. Do you think the fact that you have that commission means, A, there's a finality to your position, your time, your appointment here, but B, also that it changes your relationship, because you're sort of slightly bridging the gap, as it were? Do you think that?
I think it's important that the Cabinet Sub-Major is commissioned, and you have to do well in your commissioning process to be in a shot of getting this job. I think having that commission in the background, the deferred commission, I don't think that influences what happens with the other warrant officer class ones here, the other sub-majors, but I think it's your experience as a regimental sub-major in a foot guards battalion and all the stuff. The fact you went through the commission process, you've just got that extra bit of experience. And it's not about the Academy Sub-Major sitting here in his ivory tower, it's about getting out and mentoring. Even warrant officers need mentored, I need mentored, and I look at everybody up and down and get points, and I pass them down as well, just make sure that everybody's doing the right thing. And it's that constant leading by example here. But I'm not afraid to ask for advice from the lowest rank if I don't know something, and I'd hope everybody, I'm an approachable character and people ask me for advice any time. But I think that having the commission and the experience as a regimental sub-major is what makes the Academy Sub-Major sort of stand out a little bit, because you've got the knowledge of quite a lot of different aspects of Army life.
And especially with your background and career, what made you join the Army in the first place?
I very rarely tell a story, actually, but I think I was going down a path when I was really young of being that typical, loads of interactions with the authorities and stuff when I was younger, nothing serious, but I think if it carried on, I'd probably be in jail or somewhere else. But I think the Army came to school one time, my school, when I was young, and I was the only person that stayed behind. I'm really interested. I've got no immediate connections to the Army apart from my great-grandfather was a brigadier randomly because he was a head teacher and he was helping out the UN, so that's the only connection I had. It looked really good, so I thought I'd sign up when I was 16, and I became a boy soldier up in Glen Course. And one time, actually, I always tell this story, is I found it so hard being away from home, even though it was in Edinburgh. I never went away from home before, and I missed all my friends. And halfway into training, I sort of phoned my mother, trying to pretend I had a knee injury and get out of training. I found it so hard, and she just said no, because you had to get mother's permission or your parents' permission to sign at the army. So she said no and hung up the phone. And I'm glad she did. I probably wouldn't be here, actually. She knew that I was just going through a blip, but I think everybody has those moments in their life, and especially when you're young. And the army's obviously changed a lot, which is great, but I think I wanted to, after that, I just wanted to prove my mum and dad that actually I can stay. And the best thing I ever did, as you said, the army, 24 years now, it's flew in.
You, of course, have had a fascinating career, because although you joined F Company Scots Guards, the incremental company in Wellington Barracks, I think it is, were thrown into ceremonial soldiering when you completed your training at ITC Catterick. You very quickly joined 1st Battalion Scots Guards, who of course were armoured infantry and have been all the time. So much of your career has been spent in Iraq or Afghanistan. How did you find fighting the warrior?
It was when we first got told we moved to Germany, I think everybody was absolutely delighted to get out of the public duty sphere. It's great. I think personally for me, public duty is fantastic, but you do need change, and that's why the guards rotate through on the blue line, etc. But we first found out moving to Germany, there was such excitement, it was electric in the battalion, and we sort of moved out of Wellington Barracks and went to Ralston Camp in Salisbury and lived there before to do our conversion before we moved to Munster. It was amazing. I think the battalion grew, we were so bonded together in the 5 years in Germany because we all stayed together, no one went home. And learning to live and fight with the warriors was fantastic. It was just a different type of soldiering. And you had multiple qualifications, whether you're a gunner, commander, driver, and a section commander on the back. Everybody was multi-roled. And to deploy, I think, to Iraq and Afghan the first time from Germany was such an effort. But once you got there, it was great. Honestly, I loved Warrior. I think it was good, and it was a good transition to help us to move to mechanised infantry.
26 tons of sex on tracks, used to call it.
Yeah.
And, of course, your second tour in Afghanistan, or on Mashtar, you had a particularly rough time. You lost your platoon commander, you lost one of your best mates. Tell us about that.
So we got the phone call on Christmas Eve 2009 to say that we're going to go probably 3 or 4 weeks earlier than what were intended to be. So obviously it was the warrior tours, so it's 11.5 and 12.5, so it was halfway in between the regular tours. So we went there, and we never knew why, we never got told, because obviously it was secret. We got there, right, 2 weeks' time, you're going to do a heli assault into a known enemy area to take the attention off the US Marines who had come down the canal. So we got a really interesting intelligence brief saying that the Taliban would probably run away and they wouldn't have much rounds. And I've worked out. So essentially it was 8 days of intense fighting. It was multiple casualties. We were essentially the deception for the Taliban who kept attacking. There was no friendlies in the village at all. There was live platoon attacks. There was young guardsmen, lance corporals fighting for their life. You were constantly had to suppress the enemy, take out patrol. It was a horrific 8 days in the cold and the rain and the mud. To then my platoon commander was extracted. He was just checking the HLS. He got shot by friendly fire, which we didn't know at the time, across the canal, because there was a no-fire line, don't fire across the canal. They did, which was really annoying. So I got a sort of tap on the back after we'd casivacked him, say, right, you're up, Sergeant Kirkwood. So for the next 3 months, I was platoon commander, and after we went back to camp, we visited the platoon commander in the hospital, and he was devastated, he'd been shot, and he was a bit delirious, and he still wanted to stay, but looking at his leg, there was no way he was going to stay, and he had to get a one-of-a-kind operation. But I sort of got handed this laptop with a live drone feed of the next compound for the next air assault attack, and the company commander was like, just plan your operation. So you had two brand new platoon commanders and the other two platoons, and you had me, a sergeant with some experience, and I thought the company commander would probably not use me as much, but actually he let us stay the first platoon, let me do my own brief, which was 20 minutes long, and the other two platoon commanders were the company commanders watching them for hours to do proper orders. But I had such good section commanders in my platoon, I gave the orders for the next assault and next air assault operation, and the commanders went and rehearsed the troops. It was brilliant. It was so good to see. It took so much pressure. But there was one moment, so we done the next air assault operation, and there was various clearing operations during the sort of next week long period, and one of them was going clear of building. So we went out and we were in three different multiples and we're sort of transitioning through a sort of forward assault, and we got pinned down with the enemy. We had Afghans with us as well, Afghan soldiers, and I just heard from the front as we're transitioning across under fire that Sergeant Walker's been hit. And a horrible feeling to know that one of your close friends has been shot, that somebody in your platoon, it's an operation you planned. So the troops couldn't really do anything. It's hard to see where the enemy's coming from. There was multiple different firefights happening with other platoons and we could no support, so we sort of got forward. And the last thing he'd said to the troops and his half of his multiple was keep your head down. So he thought before his own safety, he thought about the rest of the guys in the multiple, and he sort of, unfortunately, was a really lucky shot coming and killed him. We didn't know at the time, but he killed him instantly. So we casualty-backed him at the same time as another guardsman shot. See, this moment, which I tell the young cadets, I was stood there up in a muddy field with a dead friend who I didn't know at the time, but really seriously injured friend, another guardsman injured, torch to the chest, everybody looking at me saying, what do we do now? And it was one of those moments where that's the pressure the young officer cadets will try to get you. You're going to feel that when things are going wrong, everybody's looking at you. And it froze, time froze. I didn't know what to do. I was like, oh my God, there's fire coming in. So something kicks in, that sort of command spirit, and we got the Kazakhs done. We sort of suppressed the enemy, we got people back in, but that was when he got taken away in the chopper and we sort of rolled in the compound. And the company man said, right, Sam Walker's dead. I think the whole company broke down and cried because he was so well liked. And obviously, Gazan McClellan, the other guy, got shot, he was okay. But we still had to go on patrol and fight for the next 3 or 4 days. That was very, probably the toughest moment of my career. And I still think about it now because you ever think, I planned that operation, totally lucky shot. And that's stuck with me. And the months went on for the rest of the tour, and I was blown up with an IED and a Warrior, which wasn't a pleasant experience. And I was glad to hand over the command to a colour sergeant who came from Santos, actually, for the last month or so, so I could back to being a sergeant. I think I needed that break because it was high intensity, but I've took lessons from that tour for my career now, and it shapes how I think, how I treat people, how people look at you, how you think in really hard moments. But yeah,
you talk about the discipline of planning and sticking with a plan. We sit in this room, and above you is the picture, photograph of the great RSM John Lord, who was perhaps one of the finest Academy Sergeant Majors and warrant officers of living memory. He had a very strong approach to discipline. Legendary when after he got captured in the Battle of Arnhem, when he was Sergeant Major 3 Para, and eventually ended up at Stalagluft 11B, when he transformed this sort of ragtag bunch into an organisation, an outfit that was so impressive that I think the Coldstream company commander, when they relieved the camp, thought actually it was fit to go on guard at Buckingham Palace. What is your approach to discipline today?
I think discipline is the basis for everything in the army. It really is. I try and relate everything we do at Santos to something that will affect people in the real world, the real army. So checking your kit when you're on operation to make sure it's serviceable, turn up on time for parade, not missing an 8-hour. Everything I say, I try and relate. And you want to have this personal discipline so that if you can do it when you're wet, cold and tired, you're going to do it again and again and again in operations, because as the young officer cadets here, there's going to be times when you're in command and you've got 100 things to do and all your troops will be resting. Have you got that personal discipline and motivation to do everything you need to do, to plan your orders, etc., still come back, do your personal admin, get a little bit of sleep, etc., etc.? And if you can't do it here when you're warm, you're comfortable, you're definitely not going to do it in the field. So we try and keep a good standard for the instructors here, and we try and keep in touch with all the officer cadets and show them how important that personal discipline and motivation is. It's the old adage of sort of my weapon, my kit, myself, and it never goes away, and that's the same for everything. But discipline, it has evolved over the years. I don't need to shout at people. I never have. I've never been a shouting screamer. I like to look at people in the eye and let them know that if they've let me down, they're disappointed, or disappointed dad, if you say it. And it generally works. I think if people respect you and they trust you and you tell them they've let you down, you have more of an impact, because someone's not going to listen if you shout and scream these days. That's not the way of the army. I think people like to be coached and mentored and shown, I've done this wrong, this is how you do it, show me again another time. And that's the good thing with Santos, you learn and mentor over the years, and things evolve, cadets evolve, staff evolve. But that's what, discipline's never going to go away. You just have to equate it to real life events to get people to understand why they're doing stuff.
As the Academy Sergeant Major, you're the epitome of the warrant officer class one. And for many people, they will probably never come across a finer warrant officer in their entire time in the army. What do you project, what image do you like to project as that image of the finest warrant officer in the British Army?
I like to project, I think I want people to look at me when I'm walking around as not jumping away and hiding in the bushes, but actually look and go, God, he looks squared away, he looks as if he knows what you're doing. I want to make sure as I'm approaching him, look the part and know what I'm doing. But obviously, I've always found myself very approachable. I always have been. I like to sit and talk in a smoking area with a cadet or a staff member, go outside, I'll go anywhere. And I think being that approachable character, when people get to know you a lot, they understand that you've got the best interests of the staff now, because there's and also Santos, because ultimately I am the biggest sort of drumbeater for Santos, because I think this place is absolutely fantastic. We're a leadership academy, we're the finest in the world, and I think a lot of people forget we're not churning out platoon commanders here to go and lead platoons into battle. That's what Brecon does and everyone else in the second phase of training. This is as a leadership journey for these young officers. And I keep going back to that example thing, is they need to look at the senior non-commissioned officers and the warrant officers and think, my God, we've definitely got the best examples here, and they know what good looks like. And I want to show them this is what good looks like in every single aspect of my life, whether it's private life, military life, outside of work, interactions with other people. That's it, that example set up.
Do you You'll play a formative role in shaping and moulding a lot of people's careers. And as you allude, it might all end up just in the army. They may end up as leaders of business, leaders of politics, leaders of corporate affairs, who knows what. What, in your mind, are the qualities of a good officer cadet?
I think humility is a massive part for anybody, but especially an officer cadet. I think some people may come from different backgrounds here, some better than others. I think it takes a lot to do the first 5 weeks here as an officer cadet and be broken down and show what normal soldiers go through in their training. But I think humility is massive, and having to learn to earn people's respect and trust, because if you have people's respect and trust, they will follow you anywhere and do anything. But you also have to learn to respect and trust the young guardsmen, the private soldiers in your section, because they've been in the army maybe 3, 4, 5 years. I think if you can have that ability to respect and trust them, listen to what they say, have your ears open most of the time rather than your mouth, and don't be afraid to ask for help. That's what I preach quite a lot. As someone who asks for advice a lot from other people, I think some cadets may find asking for advice a sign of weakness, and it's not. It's a sign that you want to understand everything that's going on and be better, the best you can be. So, yeah.
You are relatively new in the post of the Academy Sergeant, but you're not a new boy, Sanders, by any stretch of imagination, having a platoon colour sergeant and so on and so forth. You must be extremely proud of that and your charges from when you're between colour sergeant and watching those young officers now develop and mature and go on to greater things. How do you find it different from being sergeant major of a battalion to academy sergeant major of a leadership academy such as Santos, the finest in the world?
I think regimental sergeant major is something you should strive your whole life. If most people in their regiments get to a certain point and think, I want to be a sergeant major. I just think it's one of those jobs. You fight your whole life to get this pinnacle, to get to this first job and be the senior soldier and the best soldier in your regiment. One of the ultimate honours. And I think you are, again, just setting this role model mentor, sort of coach to everybody in the battalion, showing everybody how it's done. And you've got the, for me especially, we went through a period of really poor manning. I think the move from Catty to Aldershot really, really hurt the battalion. I think everybody was, throughout the regiment, families really hurting, and we went through a process over 2 years of trying to recruit and retain and get people to rejoin, which worked really, really well. And the move back to Catterick has helped a lot. So for me, I took great personal interest in on understanding why people were leaving the army, seeing if there's anything I could do to help them on the way out, or anything I could do to help them make them stay, essentially. I think there's been a thing in the past where if you're leaving the army, you're sort of, oh. But I didn't want, we as a battalion command officer and all the, and myself, we wanted to help people on the way out so they would have a positive experience and maybe sell the regiment, which worked. And not, and it didn't work with every single person, but most people, because we talk a good game with regimental families, but we actually have to be a regimental family. So whether that's talking to the old boys in Zoom conversations during the COVID to keep them updated on the regiment, which I really, really enjoyed, or working with the young cadets, cadet forces, I tried to dip my fingers in absolutely everything to keep connected. I think you get that pride as a sergeant major. You want to be the one who gives out information, can receive any sort of request over whatever social media, and you want to talk and brief up people in the regiment how good they're doing and sell it so people still feel connected to the regiment family. And that's why finishing on the troop for me after two amazing years was really special. I guess it was the perfect end. And then to move on to this job, I still do the same thing. I reach out to the cadet forces, ex-serving members, but also you're trying to mentor and manage all the staff here, because you ultimately want these colour sergeant staff sergeants here are going to be the next company sergeant major in the battalion and be future regiment sergeant major. So again, it's that example, it's giving them that advice from your experience as a regiment sergeant major, pitfalls and good times, and they'll pick stuff up, good or bad, from me and the other warrant officers. And that, I think that's key, and that's what people hopefully did in the battalion. They looked at me and went, right, take the good bits from him, take the bad bits from him, and I'm going to form something around what I saw of him. And I think it was quite positive. So when I left, we were in really good shape. Scots Guard were really well. We're thrusting upwards, and the battalion's in great shape now. They're in Belize, having a great time. But Catterick, really positive. But yeah, it was a great time.
Yeah. We talked about Afghanistan previously, and all the hard work and effort that you put in on those tours and so on out there, and how did you find watching the withdrawal and the recent events out there take place, and therefore essentially all your efforts and your comrades' lives and so on seemed to feel as if that was a waste of an effort, or
No, I don't think it was a waste of an effort. I think all the units that went over there, we all did the job we were asked to do. Sometimes above and beyond. I think when I looked at the withdrawal, I said to the wife when I'd seen it on the news, I was just a bit sad, a bit disappointed. Mostly, I think, for the people we lost over there, because the Scots Guards, we lost 4 soldiers in Afghan and multiple wounded. But you do think, what was it for? I think we made a difference to the people in the area we were at. Although we weren't involved in the withdrawal, I still think every unit had an impact as they went through Afghanistan, and there's loads of stats out there to show that more people in school, etc. So we did, I think we had an impact, we really did. And people look at it as if, well, it was a waste and stuff. I think it was just a sad way to end. I knew a couple of people involved in the sort of Kabul stuff at the end, and it just seemed a bit chaotic. But personally, I felt sad and disappointed. I thought there was, I was hoping there was more we could do, and yeah.
I think the chief of defence staff had it when he said that the British soldier can certainly hold his head high because he's all her head high, because they certainly acquit themselves well on the ground. I don't think that anybody would ever, question that, and that is certainly where I come from, and with my own family's involvement with it. How do you find being back at Sandhurst now?
It's great. When I got here, it's obviously very hard to get in here as a colour sergeant or staff sergeant. You've got to do the cadre, which is this mythical beast every year, and 60 of the best sergeants come, and after 3-4 weeks the 30 best get chosen and become colour sergeants or staff sergeants straight away. So to get selected there was a massive thing, and I was newly married, even though I've been with my girlfriend at the time for 8 years. It was her first married quarter here, and she's from Germany, so a big culture shock. We never had any children at the time, and it was fantastic. It was such a great place to live for 2 years. I had my platoon for the full year, from junior term all the way to commission. I still chat to nearly every single one of them. They always pop in at the office now and again. And I just think it breeds such good relationships between the instructors, because you're going to make relationships here that you last forever. And that includes connections in the future. You're mixing with officers of all ranks and being comfortable around senior ranks. As a young colour sergeant battalion, don't get that. And you just understand officers a lot better. It's like, for instance, we just did long reach. I remember as a young sergeant on the Canada having to do long reach, 60, 70 k's over the Black Mountains. And you're looking at these cadets in week 8, unsupervised, cutting around the Black Mountains, navigating themselves, radio, and as a bunch of sergeants, we're looking at each other, racing them, knackered, and most have been in the army 10 years, and you're just thinking, phew. I think that's when I first realised that Sanders is probably not what we all thought before you got here. Once you get here as an instructor, you see that the cadets are basically on the go for a full year, and after week 5, they are on a leadership journey, which ultimately they leave Santos, do whatever they do afterwards, get to the battalion, and they're expected to lead soldiers. Whereas when I'm in training, I was expected to get told what to do when I left training. So it can be a lot of pressure, but I loved it here as a colour sergeant, and I definitely thought, I never got to come back as a company sergeant major because I put into the RQMS jobs, but I would have come back in a heartbeat, and the chance to come back as a company sergeant major, I absolutely jumped on it because it is the best place. I know I've got 2 young children, got a 6 and a 3 year old. I live in the Karen Sergeant Major's house, which is great, and my 2 kids love it. I wish I had kids the first time, but now I'm definitely going to enjoy the 2 years here.
You talk about understanding officers, and I talk about an officer that he never quite fits into the mould. How do you understand an officer?
Again, when I was a platoon sergeant and before that, you've seen a numerous amount of officers come up to the platoon commander slot, and you just always looked at them as this really... And the guards at the time, really posh and fit officers who would do bits and bobs, and the sergeant would probably run the platoon. And just thinking, oh. But actually when you come here and you realise all the stuff they go through, all the leadership journey, the toils, the highs, the lows, everything they do to get the commission, it is unbelievable. The amount of information, lessons they've got to process to leave here, to go and do Brecon or other phase 2, and then go and potentially lead a platoon of 30 troops, age 19 to whatever age it is, a lot of responsibility. And I think I couldn't have done that. I couldn't do what they do in week 8 of training when I was a young guardsman. I'd be lost, whatever else in the mountains. But all the cadets want to be here, which makes instructing here fantastic. They all want to be here. They're all absolutely motivated, keen as mustard. Integrity is absolutely on point, which makes things a lot easier. It's special. I just think until you've instructed here, understood what they go through, you probably don't get officers unless you've been here.
How long will you hold the appointment of a county sergeant major for?
So it's 2 years. So it used to be a long time. So I think it went from in the past it was 10, 7, 5, 3. Now it's 22 because the terms of service have changed now. So it's a 2 years appointment, and then whoever takes over me will have to go through the same process, the commission process, and then compete with each other to be selected. So I've been here until August 2023.
Do you think in a way that's almost too short? I mean, as you're just getting your feet under the table when it's time.
I would love to do it. If I could, I would stay in. I'd stay for 4 years if I could. If they said to me, "Joy, stay on for 2 more years," I would. It's great, yeah. You take a term to get your feet under the table, and then you've only got 5 more terms and you're moving on. Mm. And it does take that term to bed in.
And after that, you will then take the tour up the steps, the portico, the grand portico at Santos itself and the old college, and your famous last words as another rank will be next left. How do you feel about that?
It's a lovely little... Until I witnessed it on the parade, I never realised that the Camp Sergeant Major marched up the steps to his slow march, and as a commissioned officer, until I took over on that Sovereign's Parade just there. It's a great little tradition. It'll be strange to march up the steps, be an officer, and that's it, move on to whatever job the next, but I just think it's a lovely little tradition, because it's special, and that'll be the sixth and final Sovereign Spirit at the time. I can't even think that far forward yet.
Cameron Sutmajor, thank you very much for being my guest on General Talk.
No problem.
My thanks to Academy Sergeant Major Kirkwood. Next month, I hope you'll join us for Friday Night In on Friday, the 25th of February, when we get together to raise money for the Army family, a chance to share a meal and your favourite drink while doing something for a good cause. As last year, there'll be an online auction, a prize draw, music from the Royal Edinburgh Military Tattoo, and much more besides, along with special guests including Gabby Logan, Michael Burke, Sam McCoy, and the Governor of Edinburgh Castle, Major General Alistair Bruce. Registration for the Pyrenees Escape Route Challenge closes on the 30th of January. The four-day trek at the end of July from France into Spain follows the escape route down which thousands of servicemen and Jewish refugees fled to safety during the Second World War. Registration for both events can be found online at soldierscharity.org. Until next month, it's farewell from me, Harry Bucknell. Keep smiling through, and thank you for listening. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.